Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Big show coming up today. We got some news on the CBA negotiations that we're going to talk about with Danny and some other news as well. Then I'm bringing on Frank Madden for a re-recorded, updated Milwaukee Bucks podcast, a little more depressing one with the Chris Middleton news, but we basically had to redo the whole thing. So hopefully those efforts will come to fruition for our listeners. We were sponsored today by Distilled Jeans. You can get started with them at distilleddstld.com/capspace. And then MeUndies, MeUndies.com/capspace is the place to go there to get 20% off your first order. Distilled, you can get $10 off your first order at that distilled.com/capspace URL. So this is one of the more optimistic podcasts that we've done, Danny, because according to Woj's report and then Adam Silver at a press conference for the games in China shortly thereafter, a lot of optimism that it looks like the CBA is going to get done and that they're just kind of working on some small issues at this point.
Yeah, it's extremely welcome news. I've been, I guess you could call it a lockout skeptic, meaning skeptical that there was going to be an agreement just because there are so many big questions with this in terms of identification, you know, like because the players took such a big hit last time in term, and there was the issues of the owners about whether where they would figure out that, you know, that point of middle ground or compromise. And even if it's just that they're close, that is a substantial step in this overall process, especially if the goal is to not lose any basketball games.
I had heard some rumblings over the summer that this might be an easier process than some anticipated. And thankfully, it looks like we're getting to that point. And I think the reason that I was a little bit worried was you had to think that Michelle Roberts coming in with a mandate didn't get elected by saying, oh, hey, guys, let's continue the status quo. That's not usually how you get elected. And the players took a haircut in the last CBA. But now with all the contracts that have been given out, and I think the owners are perfectly happy with things. They're making money hand over fist these days with the new TV deal. That riding tide has lifted all boats enough to where maybe the players weren't really going to fight too hard over the revenue. And then there's some other things. It sounds like, you know, one of the things that Woj talked about was that the rookie scale is going to increase. I think we all thought that that was going to be coming. And that's probably the biggest no-brainer in these negotiations for everybody because the rookie salaries were just too low at this point. So maybe it just has turned out that the players are doing well enough that they didn't want to upset the apple cart too much.
That seems like the most likely interpretation, considering the precedent of owners scratching and clawing for everything. And I'm not going to necessarily criticize them for that because that is their right. And that also leaves a lot of time to resolve some of these, you know, system issues. And part of what led to a lot of the large scale problems or things that needed adjusting, let's say, in the last CBA was that big parts of it were rushed because they were under this time pressure to get to games starting by Christmas and doing all that. And so a couple of the situations, the most notable one for me, and I've written about this at length, is how they fundamentally messed up the extension system. And so players hit unrestricted free agency who never would have before. And that led to a lot of the crazy stuff that's happened, including Kevin Durant to the Warriors. And those issues were, as I said, because some they had to push some stuff through and they maybe didn't think about the consequences and break through it. But if they have a lot of the big stuff solved at this point, even if they don't come to like a real, you know, ironclad, have the CBA signed, sealed, and delivered before the opt-out date, if they're that close, they should be able to get a lot of those things right.
Yeah, and Silver expressed some optimism that even within the next few weeks, they might be able to get things done. And, you know, I thought that maybe what this compromise solution was going to be to give the players a little bit more upside. Currently, it's at a 49-51 range, depending on how much the revenue is. The more revenue, the more the players get. The players have been getting really 51 automatically. It's been so incredible, the growth in the league's revenue. So you would think that maybe the compromise would be all right in the boom times, they could get 52 or 53%. But just based on the tenor of things, it seems like maybe that's not even going to be the case. And we'll see how many of these smaller issues get adjusted, whether the max salary can go up a little bit. I mean, we've talked ad nauseum about some of the changes that we would like to see. And we probably won't find out, I don't think, until things are actually done, what those are going to be. But I think it's good news, both for the fact that we're not going to have any lockout, but also for teams that have really planned based on some of the cap estimates in the future. It certainly sounds like there's not going to be a radical change from this CBA, and that'll help teams a lot. You know, much like we saw with the 2005 CBA compared to 1999, there were not radical changes. They did reduce the contract length. I don't think we're even going to see anything that extreme in terms of what the changes are going to be. So this is good news. It's good news for us CBA dorks because we're not going to have that much new stuff to learn.
Well, so there's one other thing I wanted to mention, which is that the possibility of having a agreed to CBA before things like the trade deadline will be a big help for planning purposes, because there uncertainty has always been this factor in terms of things, whether it be another amnesty provision or just where the salary cap might be. And so if they have a better idea of where this is going, it will allow teams to have a better calibration when they're making trades and decisions in February, much less in by the draft, where it should all definitely be settled.
This is an aside, but I really hope they don't have another amnesty.
For me, it really does depend. I think that there is a reason to, you know, it's one of those things that's kind of popular from a lot of different sides, but it is an excuse for bad behavior, and I don't love excuses for bad behavior.
Yeah, it's exactly right. A lot of teams, I think, signed some pretty bad contracts in 2016, and so allowing an amnesty to let teams get out of that and excusing that poor planning, it's kind of an anti-competitive stance, in my view. All right, let's anything else you want to say on that, or should we move on?
We'll move on. I mean, I'm sure we can at various moments advocate for some small things, as you and I both have done in the past.
Darren Collison suspended for 8 games to start the year. We had speculated that it would be around 10. I think that was you, actually. So you were pretty close on that. We noted the contrast with Jeff Taylor, who got 24 games a couple of years ago when domestic violence was really in the news. I am not sure how different the PR... Well, I know the PR environment is different, but I'm not sure how different the details of the case between Darren Collison and Taylor are. But it does seem, at least, that the league had consulted with domestic violence experts. They also claimed that Collison's contrition and taking responsibility was something that they brought into consideration as well. And in the old days, you know, this would have been a 2-game suspension probably. So I think we could talk about whether that's right or wrong or not. It doesn't really interest me too much, frankly. But what does this mean now for the Kings missing their starting point guard for the first 8 games of the season?
They're going to be putting a lot more pressure on guys that, you know, don't have as much of a background in terms of present quality as they do. You know, Ty Lawson might end up be starting a fair amount of these 8 games for them. He actually looked pretty good. I went to the untelevised Warriors Kings game in San Jose on Thursday, and Lawson started that game and looked pretty good. You know, he looked physically better than he did last year for sure. And then Garrett Temple will probably get meaningful minutes running the offense as well. And I have been skeptical about that in the past. Just, I don't think that's the best role for him. And from what I recall, it's a relatively tough stretch for the Kings. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean a lot just because...
Yeah, here, I've got their schedule actually in front of me. So at Suns to start, that's the opener. Spurs at home on a back-to-back, Wolves at home, and then one of the earliest long other conference road trips I can remember a team having in a season, at Hawks, at Heat, at Magic, at Bucks, at Raptors, and that will conclude their first 8 games. So really, and they'll play 6 of their first 8 on the road without Collison. And this is a team that really needs to get off to a good start, I think, just for everyone's sanity and just the fact that they've been picking in the top 10 basically forever now. And you don't want this feeling of here it goes again. And so missing their starting point guard for that stretch could be rather difficult.
Yeah, that's a major concern for them, and a team that has had seasons spiral out of control at moments. And so while the hope is that Jaeger can help that, and just that they're getting on more solid footing in a couple of different ways, that it can be, but those sorts of things, if they stumble, let's say they go 3-5, 2-6, can be hard to recover from, even though I don't think either of us feels that the playoff berth, which is probably their definition of success in the West, is going to be as tough as it has been in previous years.
In Detroit, Reggie Jackson, severe tendonitis in his knee. He is out 6 to 8 weeks. And that, I've had really bad tendonitis before that it took me a long time to recover from. And that definitely indicates, you just have to take some time and let it rest when it gets that bad. So what does this mean for them? They did at least pick up Ish Smith. I think that Ish, in some ways, is almost better as a starter than a guy coming off the bench, because he has shown that he can fill in that role, and maybe he won't be asked to do quite as much. On the other hand, though, you could argue that because he doesn't shoot it as well, having more playmakers around him when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, he's a little bit more of a liability. But the Pistons were very, very reliant on Reggie Jackson a year ago. Now that they have Tobias Harris, that should help a little bit. But for a team that people were hoping would take the next step, maybe even get into the top four in the East this year, this is not the way to start it.
It isn't. They have now what they didn't before, a little bit of a Memphis problem, which is what the same issue that Memphis has this year, where they have a capable guy who can run the offense. I mean, Ish Smith was a little bit overhyped last year, you know, with everything that happened in New Orleans and them getting 2 second-round picks for him. But at least he can do some things out there. And then Tobias Harris kind of plays that Chandler Parsons role. And so you think, okay, you have two guys who can create, one who's more of a primary, one who's more of a secondary. But then that's really all they have. Their bench now is rough. You know, they spend a lot of resources on other things. They have shockingly great big man depth, but those guys can't really create offense for themselves. And they don't even have a guy, let's say, like DeMarcus Cousins. You know, Drummond and Cousins are very different players. Cousins can generate offense for himself. And other than offensive rebounds, Drummond doesn't really do that. So they're going to need more just people who are good with the ball in their hands in that offense. They're going to need people to step up. And Smith, I would say, is a worse defender than Jackson. Jackson is overrated as a defender, but is still better than Ish Smith. And so they're going to have to work through all this, and they're going to be tightroping really without a net because they don't have another guy behind them to step up in case anything happens.
Yeah, Lorenzo Brown and Ray McCallum were competing to make this team, and neither of those guys has much of a pedigree as ever really been an effective rotation player in the league. And while Reggie Jackson is not the best player on the Pistons, I think that's Drummond, he is definitely their most indispensable player just due to the lack of playmaking that they have off the dribble. And I know that that was something that you really focused on as something you wish they had done better in the offseason, was to get a little bit more playmaking and guys who can attack or just score, even someone, you know, who can microwave off the bench. And not having those guys, I think we could see these guys really struggle to score a lot. Maybe the defense will get a little bit better, maybe not. So it's going to be a rough start to the year for these guys without Reggie Jackson, for sure. Let's move on to a report from Dan Wojcicki that this might be the year the Clippers finally stagger Blake Griffin and Chris Paul. Doc Rivers has been talking about doing that. I think they've been doing it in the preseason. And hallelujah from all of us who have watched the Clippers load these many years.
It's amazing that it has taken this long, considering it is pretty manifestly obvious that,
hey, if Oklahoma City could do it last year with Westbrook and Durant, maybe the Clippers can see the light too.
Better late than never, for sure. Better earlier than later. But that's an issue that we don't really need to discuss now. And what is fascinating about this from the Clippers' perspective is what they're going to do in terms of the power forward in those lineups, because they have Brandon Bass. He's probably going to be the guy that fits that, but he has very different, you know, strengths and weaknesses as Blake Griffin. And that's always been a part of the kind of question for me, at least, with why Doc hesitated on this, was that, yeah, you Blake on the second unit fixes a lot of things, especially because Austin Rivers is not really the guy who you should have running your offense, but you have to have somebody to replace Blake at that point. And it can be hard for a coach who thinks of starters as starters to really do that. And then also, this fundamentally, as much as I support the move and think it should happen, it's going to change things for Jamal Crawford, because Jamal Crawford has been at least in terms of counting stats, has been a beneficiary of this. He just signed a, you know, lucrative contract that will presumably be his last big one. And now there's going to be somebody else who's going to have the ball in his hands a whole heck of a lot. So I think it will work. I'm happy they're doing it, but it is not this, you know, hunky-dory, really easy change. It's going to take some real work from them.
I wonder what the impetus for this was. Maybe it was that they did so well last year when Griffin was out for more than half the year, basically, and running the offense with Chris Paul and DeAndre Jordan pick and rolls as the centerpiece with getting more spacing. Maybe Doc came to the realization that that could function so well that using Blake on the second unit might be a better way to do that, that maybe you don't get as many, you kind of get diminishing marginal returns in some respects by having CP and Blake on the floor at all times. And we'll see how Blake looks. You know, reports are that he's more explosive again, that he's fully recovered from that quad injury, but he has been injury prone these last couple of years, has had a number of knee injuries. So I'll be looking forward to watching the Clippers, and we should be recording a Clippers offseason pod later this week, so we'll get much more into them at that point. I don't want to say report, because I know Brian kind of rails against this, but a discussion between Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin, both with deep Cleveland ties, of course, on our rival True Hoop podcast, and they discussed the J.R. Smith situation a bit, and they didn't have firm numbers, but it sounded like from their discussion that basically the offer that's kind of on the table now for J.R.'s age 30 is 4 years, $42 million or so, with a fourth year non-guaranteed. What do you think of that kind of a range for J.R.?
It's lower than I would have demanded if I were him, just because he has so much leverage. You know, this is kind of a Tristan Thompson situation where...
Well, does he have leverage, though? Because where else can he sign? That's the question. I mean, he has leverage in the sense that I think he's worth more. You know, if you look at, I mean, Courtney Lee, he should get more money than Courtney Lee. He's a better player than Courtney Lee on the court. You know, he has these character issues, obviously, that have bedeviled him in the past. But, you know, so he has leverage in that sense. I mean, if you just look at, hey, this is what other guys got, this is what I should get. Yeah, but everyone knows he doesn't want to go anywhere else. There's nowhere else that wants to sign him. So in that respect, he doesn't have leverage. It's a tricky situation, and I think that's why they're having such difficulty resolving it.
In their unique spot, I focus a lot more on his individual leverage with them than really the competitors, because the competitors don't really matter. And the fact that LeBron James is advocating so stringently for him and has a really good reason for it is more notable in that sense. And the other big point in this is that...
JR, of course, with Clutch Sports,
is that the Cavs aren't losing anything in terms of future flexibility either. Like, this is a team that's capped out for the next few seasons. LeBron signed a 2-year deal with a player option, but we all expect he'll opt out at that point. You know, and they have Kyrie and they have Tristan and Kevin Love under contract. So it's not like they're sacrificing, like, a situation, let's say, like the Knicks or the Lakers or something, where they're sacrificing the chance of being players in 2017 or 2018. So
yeah, it's all Gilbert's luxury tag money. That's the issue. And that was in large part the same issue with Tristan Thompson last year as well. And they finally allowed him to save face a little bit and added an extra $2 million to their offer. Although, interestingly, on that podcast, they also reported, said that some of the earlier offers from the Cavs to Thompson also included a non-guarantee at the end, which was taken off. But so we'll see. I mean, where do you think this should land? Like, should land or will land, if there are two different answers to that question?
$339 million as the guaranteed portion, and then if they want to do something after that, they do something after that. But about $13 million a year seems fair, and 4 years fully guaranteed is a lot for somebody at kind of his point in this process, and also 3 years lines up relatively well with everybody else in their system. So something in that range. But, you know, I don't think that fighting over, you know, $2 million for a year, JR has, it's not like he's been destitute for his career. This is not like Hassan Whiteside, who had been basically playing at the minimum until he got that max deal. So I could see that as a you know, maybe it's a little bit, it ends up a little bit lower than that, but $13 million a year for 3 years seems fair.
The luxury tax is the big constraint here, because I think if I were Cleveland and all I cared about was just basketball, he's 30, I would want to go, all right, let's sign you up for 3 years here, maybe even 2 years with a non-guaranteed third year, but we'll just pay you a ton. We have your full bird rights. We'll pay you a ton for those couple of years. And then, you know, once, because frankly, Smith probably is at the point where he won't be worth more than eight figures in the third and fourth years of that contract as he gets into his mid-30s and really shifts into what'll have to be a reserve role by that point. So I would love to just be able to pay him more on a shorter term deal, but then you got to take the hit with the luxury tax too. And I think they would much rather spread it out from a financial perspective over those number of years. And I think for Smith too, someone who finally has found a home in Cleveland, I think just having the stability of a longer contract might be something that appeals to him as well, even if it's not purely about financial gain. So we'll see. I mean, if that's what the offer is, you know, maybe it gets up to like 4 for $50 million or so, and there is still a little bit of a non-guarantee on that last year. I think that would probably be fair. I think if JR had tried a little harder to get the best offer that he could on the market. He could have done better than this, but that opportunity is now unfortunately passed him by. And so with the diminished leverage, I think, you know, something in the 4 for 50 range would be fair, in my opinion.
Are we back, ready to go back into injury mode? I think where we have to start, the great state of Utah would probably like to hear our thoughts on the whole Gordon Hayward thing.
Yeah, this is, we talked about both liking their over. I can't remember whether one or both of us put a little bit of money on that. And Hayward is probably their most indispensable player. They have never really succeeded offensively with him off the floor in these last few years since Millsap and Jefferson left town. But they are much, much better positioned to withstand this now with Joe Johnson, Rodney Hood hopefully taking a step forward. They got Exum back now, although he did leave as a precautionary measure with a slight hyperextension of that left knee that he had injured, but he looked okay. I saw a little bit of those preseason games that he played in. So they've got a lot more depth, obviously, to deal with this, but it's still difficult for them. And he really is the one guy that you look at as really being dynamic off the dribble on this team at this point in time. Hood is a decent player, but not someone you want as your number one creator in the pick and roll. So I do expect that Utah could struggle a little bit offensively, but fortunately they have their depth and they have their defense to rely on. They also have a pretty difficult schedule early on, and I think in their first 11 games, and then they have, David Locke was tweeting this, I think 16 of their 18 games, you could say that they're favored in after that stretch in the first 11. So they stay afloat there. If they can get to 500 during that stretch, and then hopefully Hayward will be back in the earlier part of that. Was it 4 to 6 weeks? Is that the time frame?
I think that's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's worrisome, but I think if this were last year or the year before, the Utah fans would really have a lot to worry about. This year, I think, you know, they've got as much depth as any team in the league.
When they got George Hill, a part of the reason why you and I both loved it so much is that he is one of the more capable off-ball guys as a point guard, and he's one of the few point guards who doesn't feel that insatiable need to have the ball in his hands all the time, and those are two different things that are both very important. But he can do it when you need him to. He did a decent enough job.
Yeah. I will say he looked awful trying to do that against Phoenix the other day.
But, that's true.
He was good 2 years ago. So maybe he's at a different point in his career right now, or he was just kind of had a good stretch 2 years ago when they really needed his offense. But yeah, I agree. I mean, he has succeeded more in that role before than you would have expected.
Yeah, and they, you know, they have Rodney Hood who can do some of that as well. And Joe Johnson can generate offense himself too, and we'll see what happens with Alec Burks. I'm not exactly sure what his status is at this point, but he's another depth piece that can help them, even though he's not really as much of an initiator except maybe in some moments on second units. But they have enough talent now, which is important, and another huge benefit to spending a little bit of money and having depth. While it's not necessarily, other than Joe Johnson at small forward, just having more depth overall helps you handle any sort of thing that can come to pass. And so I was so critical of Detroit before all this happened about the idea of that they didn't really have replacements and all that stuff. And it's true that Utah doesn't have a direct one, but at least they have more guys. And so they have more potential ways to solve the problem, even if it doesn't fix it entirely.
All right, lightning round here. Kelly Olynyk, not yet cleared for contact. He's been doing non-contact stuff, hasn't played in the preseason with that shoulder injury. I think a decent comparison is Kevin Love last year, who
incidentally
was that it actually is rather ironic. You know, I think they had relatively similar injuries, and then Kelly, you know, is kind of, I think, about the same point where Love was, and hopefully he can get cleared and be in the rotation. But they have Tyler Zeller there. Even Jordan Mickey might be able to be competent for them. So not the end of the world if he can't be ready quite yet, but it would be good for him to see sometime, at least in the preseason, before things start. Gary Harris expected to miss 4 to 6 weeks with a partially torn groin. This might be a good chance for Will Barton to get showcased for a trade.
Or Jamal Murray to get Rookie of the Year candidacy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, and Murray has been relatively impressive. I actually, as soon as we get off here, I'm going to watch the game tonight. But Murray has had some moments from what I have seen on Twitter during the preseason. And, you know, we both liked him. Zach Randolph in Memphis is going to be coming off the bench in favor of or ceding to Jamichael Green. Rather, what do you think of that?
They don't really need Zach Randolph's offensive value because they have the additional creation of Chandler Parsons, and JaMychal Green gives them...
Well, we hope.
Yeah, JaMychal Green gives them more athleticism.
He has not yet been cleared either, which is a concern. Actually, I'm going to talk to do our Memphis preview later this week, so we'll get into that more. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I mean, he said the right things about it. He is a little bit older, although I still think that he thinks he can do it. I think it's more of a defensive issue for them than an offensive issue. And as you said, playing him less minutes, playing with the second unit, seems like it could work. But, you know, Dave Yeager kind of tried this to make them a little more quote unquote modern. We'll see what happens.
Well, and it aligns so well with the idea that has been a theme of Dunked On almost since we started, about having these more offensive first big men on second units. And Zebo has become that just because of Father Time. But what's strange about it is that Randolph fits in, the other big man, presumably the fourth big man in their rotation, is Brandon Wright, and they don't particularly mesh in terms of that idea of a second unit. But, you know, that's enough talent that it should be able to work, and that also helps them considering Memphis's limited shot creation on the second unit. Having Zach Randolph there could help that a lot.
Some welcome news for Knicks fans out of New York today. Derrick Rose still has been missing time due to his sexual assault civil case. Joakim Noah, hamstring injury, probably won't be back until the weekend for preseason, won't play tomorrow. But Jeff Hornacek said to the press basically that the Knicks can't run the triangle all the time and guys don't like to run it. And so it'll be more after timeouts and on sideline out of bounds when we'll see triangle for them. And I think given the skill set of Porzingis, of Rose, that is going to be welcome news for Knicks fans, if in fact that's really how it turns out.
Let's hope.
All right, we done here?
What, do you want to talk quickly about Poindexter, just as a call?
Oh, yeah. Detail? Yeah, I mean, I think he still has no timetable. You know, it was said by Alvin Gentry, or actually Del Demps, that it could be November, December, or January. And the lesson here, Tim McMahon talked about this too on the Mavs preview that we did last week with Chandler Parsons. If you have a knee injury, especially one that impacts cartilage, don't play on it. Please just don't. Like Coupon and Parsons both had pretty similar stories in the sense that they kind of hid things from the training staff and didn't want to sit. And, you know, when you have a cartilage injury, you can play on it at the time. It just, you know, it hurts. I think that's the biggest problem. But, you know, you're going to suffer long-term damage. You keep on missing the whole year last year, had to have another surgery, and that was back in February. And so he's still not ready now in November. I mean, pretty crazy that he will, if he even does come back at that point, he'll have missed nearly 2 years of basketball from that injury, which is really a shame.
Yeah, and I remember it was a contract that we both really liked and how they acquired him in the trade. He really helped them the year they made the playoffs, and then he basically has been a zero since then, which is unfortunate considering his talent.
All right, let's get to Frank Madden, but first, this word.
We're sponsored today by Distilled, which has revolutionized the fashion industry by creating timeless, luxury-grade denim, so you get jeans that would cost you hundreds of dollars starting at $65. I've got a pair of the 14-ounce Blackline Selvage jeans, $125, which is the most expensive pair because they start at around $65. But these type of jeans would cost you almost $300. And I've never been willing to pay that much for jeans because that's a ridiculous price. But because Distilled, spelled D-S-T-L-D, doesn't work with department stores or retail middlemen, there's no markup, there's no bullshit, just great jeans at a great price. So go to distilled.com, D-S-T-L-D.com, and find the perfect pair for you. Of course, my listeners can get a great discount off of their first pair by going to distilled.com, DSTLD.com/capspace. That's a URL, easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. Distilled.com/capspace, and you get $10 off your first pair. That's distilled.com, DSTLD.com/capspace for $10 off.
Hey, Nate.
What's up, man? How are you?
Good. How's the audio? Good enough?
Yeah, you sound pretty good, actually. Yeah, I was actually just Googled you just to make sure I had like had it right of how I was going to introduce you. And then I realized that there is apparently a equestrian show jumping trainer by the name of Frank Madden.
Yeah,
although you are first in Google image searches.
Yeah, my life goal is to eclipse the equestrian Frank Madden in Google. That's basically, I'll have made it if I ever get to that point.
It was a big moment for me when I became the highest result for Nate Duncan, eclipsing this like incredibly handsome Bay Area model named Nate Duncan.
Your alter ego in the Bay Area.
But yeah, all right. Actually, I might just use this to start with. Tell the people, this is the Bucks preview, by the way. But you know that because you saw it in the show description. Tell people just who you are and what you do, real quick, before we get started here.
Sure, I'm Frank Madden, the non-equestrian version, and I'm the founder and editor, I guess, of Brewhoop.com, ISB Nation's Bucks site, which I've been running since 2007. You can check me on Twitter at Brewhoop, and also since July, I've been doing the Locked On Bucks podcast as part of the Locked On Network with my Brewhoop co-conspirator Eric Name. So if anyone has a huge need for more and basically daily Bucks talk, I can hopefully help with that as well.
So you have a very difficult mantle to live up to, because Jeremy Schmidt, the last time he was on the show, he now sadly has retired from the basketball media game, it seems, but he was the only team blogger to actually pick less wins for his team than their over-under was. And I don't want to spoil it, but just in general, do you think that you can live up to Jeremy's Bucks pessimism?
Well, I mean, I've been trying to live up to Jeremy's pessimism slash cynicism my entire career. Jeremy's a good friend of mine, and was definitely sad to hear that he was, you know, semi-retiring. And we were joking the other day, he did a podcast with us earlier this summer, and so I'm gonna try to drag him out to a podcast with us hopefully somewhat regularly this year. But yeah, I mean, I think the under last year was a pretty common thing for those of us who, you know, were around Jeremy enough to catch his pessimism.
Jeremy, I will miss him. He's actually one of the first NBA media people I ever met in person at Sloan in 2012. We regaled each other with our memories of the 1990-91 Milwaukee Bucks team, which featured some of my all-time favorites like Frank Brakowski, Dan Shays was in the twilight of his career.
Yeah, Dan Shays was my neighbor. He was my neighbor in growing up. Dan Shays, he lived a few houses down.
Oh wow, yeah. One of the and as a Jewish man, I can say this, one of the all-time best Jewish NBA players. That
not as good as his dad, though. Not as good
no,
as his dad.
That's true. Maybe of my lifetime would be a better a better way of putting it. Brad Lohaus was on that team, and also Fred Roberts, who might have been actually like the guy that we made fun of the most of like my group of like NBA loving friends, which numbered one other person when I was a 10-year-old. So yeah, that was a truly classic team that somehow was still good. They're like the 4 seed in the East that year.
I have one quick Fred Roberts story. Fred Roberts came to a basketball camp that I went to in 4th grade, maybe. I mean, basically, it would have been right around that time. And so this was at Homestead High School in Mequon, Wisconsin. Shout out to Mequon for any Milwaukee / Wisconsinites listening tonight. But and Fred Roberts showed up, and I don't remember anything that Fred Roberts did as far as, you know, like normally when guys show up at, you know, at a basketball camp with a bunch of kids, you know, it's like, oh, the kids want him to dunk or whatever. I don't remember Fred Roberts doing anything like that. But at one point, he challenged all of us to a race the length of the court. And spoiler alert, he won. The NBA player beat the 4th graders. And I still don't know why that was his like feat of athleticism.
Everyone could participate there. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess
Fred, probably one of the more distinctive haircuts in NBA history. Yes. I would say he kind of had like the crew cut, but also like the slightly longer on top comb forward.
And he had the kind of power alleys, like he had a little bit of that little receding hairline. So that made the buzz kind of even more like severe feeling. So yeah, he had one of the more memorable kind of 90s, early 90s NBA haircuts. So shout out to Fred Roberts.
All right. Now we should talk about a Bucks team that probably is not going to win as many games as that 90-91 team.
So in the interest of full disclosure, we actually recorded a whole podcast on this about a month ago, and then I went on vacation, and during that vacation we found out that Chris Middleton is going to be out for up to 6 months
with a hamstring injury. And that, to me, just changes everything for this team.
Yeah, this team is, I think, you know, whereas I previously would have said this is a team that, you know, had a fighter's shot at one of the final playoff spots in the East, a team that, you know, could reasonably shoot for, you know, low 40s in terms of wins and see if they could get there without Chris, you know, a guy that I think they were 8 or 9 points better offensively, 3 or 4 points better defensively last year. You lose him and then not really having anybody close to his caliber that you can really slot in for him. It's a huge blow. So it definitely, I mean, we'll get to the over-under talk, I guess, later. But it absolutely, I think, you know, knocks them down and out of that, you know, kind of big cluster of teams that were all firing, you know, really looking for the playoffs, and probably throws them in with Miami, maybe into that kind of lower, maybe not quite Brooklyn and 76ers tier, but definitely, you know, probably on the outside right now of the other teams there that are going to be fighting for playoff positioning.
Yeah, Middleton had a negative 0.1 net rating last year in over 2,800 minutes. That actually was by far the best on the team. The only rotation player coming back who the second best was Giannis. He was all the way down at negative 2.6. So you see how important he was when he was on the floor. And then this is probably the position at which they are the least deep. I mean, even an injury to Jabari or Giannis, those guys are at least a little bit redundant with one another. You've got Teletovic, who could play some power forward, but they really have nothing behind Middleton, and that's as much of a problem as the fact of that he's really good to begin with.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, you could certainly make a strong case for Chris having been the most valuable player on the team last year, or at least the most indispensable. We'll get into Giannis. Obviously, Giannis was great after the All-Star break, but certainly over the entire season, tough to make the case for anybody but Chris really last year. And at this year, even if you think Giannis and Jabari are going to make huge improvements, Chris, because of his shooting, because of what he does on both ends, and sort of the malleability of what he can do and fit into different lineups. At a minimum, I think you'd say he's probably the most indispensable team guy on the roster. So going from that to, you know, Rashad Vaughn / Jason Terry / Malcolm Brogdon / MCW and Dellavedova sliding over from the one, that is a big drop off. And, you know, not surprisingly, we've heard the Bucks sort of, you know, go into, well, I don't know if I want to say panic, but certainly they seem to be very active looking for potential options to try to add a shooting guard here before the season starts.
Well, and not only is it that they don't have any good backup shooting guards, it's that he really was the only guy you look at as a high volume guy from three on this team, a team that took, as I recall, only 15 three-pointers per game last year, which was by far last in the league. Or maybe it wasn't 15, it might have been 15% of their shots were threes or something like that. It was, but whatever.
It was just under 16. Yeah, you're not far off.
Yeah, so, and forgive me for remembering that for a month ago, but it's, and so he is the only guy on the team that provides that skill. I want to say, did he make like half of their threes or something like that last year?
I think it was around a third. I think he hit 142, and I think I was doing the math. If you look at all the guys they lost in free agency / whatever else, and then you add Chris, they lost, I think, 385 of the 443s they hit last year. And they added, so Teletovic hit 181. So he's, even with compared to Chris, he's the highest volume guy on the team. But you add Dellavedova and Jet in there as well. Those guys hit 372 last year. So, you know, in fewer combined minutes than the guys that we're taking out. But certainly for a team that is starting from a just massive, massively low baseline in terms of shooting threes. They've talked about wanting to shoot threes. You know, we've heard that Jabari and Giannis are going to shoot more threes, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, to get anywhere close to kind of league average in terms of makes and attempts, it's going to be, you know, a big effort. And guys are really going to have to sort of change, I think, their approach. And so far in the preseason, there have been maybe a little bit of hints, yes. But I think that's going to be a fascinating thing to see if they can do that, because obviously difficult to be, you know, an average offense if you're not shooting at least a decent number and making a decent number of threes.
Well, last thing on Middleton, because we do want to talk about how this team's going to look this year, but 6 months for a hamstring injury? I can't remember ever hearing something like that, that kind of a timetable for a hamstring injury. Can you shed any more light just on the details of the injury itself?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, it wasn't a crazy play. It sounds like it was just they were playing pickup basically the day before training camp. Was basically the same day that Giannis had his press conference, and Chris actually came in and I think he had it wrapped. So it actually happened that day, I believe. He didn't think it was that bad. He basically slipped and kind of did the splits or something. And, you know, went through the day, went to the press conference, was saying nice things about Giannis at his press conference. And then the next day, the news breaks that, you know, he's not only out, but he's out for 6 months. And apparently it's, you know, a complete tear of the hamstring off the bone, which, you know, is scary. And there's some numbers that I've looked up on this. You know, guys can come back from this, but it's a muscle injury. I mean, these things are tricky. The idea of the Bucks bringing him back in, you know, March, I mean, who knows where this team is going to be in March. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this is handled. And certainly as somebody who, you know, looks at this team as very much a, you know, still a long-term project, not one that is about this season. You would certainly hope that the team will do, you know, will veer on the caution, on the side of caution. And, you know, if Chris doesn't play at all this year, I don't think that probably matters at this point. Just, you know, get him ready for next fall. And yeah, because I was the same way. 6 months, you know, it's such a long number for a muscle injury. A lot of times they drag out, but rare to see it, you know, just diagnosed right off the bat that basically a guy's gone for the season before it even starts.
Yeah, and muscle injuries, I think, can linger in a way that a lot of other injuries might not, you know, even like a broken bone. You know, it's definitely the type of thing where, you know, you just don't have that same level of flexibility and you're just always going to get adhesions and it's just always going to be tight probably and prone to re-injury as well when you have this severe of a hamstring injury. Is this better for the Milwaukee Bucks in the long term that this happened? Is there a way to say that?
I think so. I'll give you the case for it. I think the case for how this is potentially a good thing long term. And I think let's start with a caveat that let's assume that Chris does come back and, you know, that this doesn't turn into some lingering thing that, you know, he's never the same player from, because obviously that's sort of the first concern is getting him back to something close to 100%. He's obviously not a guy who bases his game on athleticism, but clearly, you know, if he can't play then he's no good to anybody as a basketball player. But if he can come back, I think the upside would be, and we're seeing it in the first two preseason games, you know, Jabari Parker in particular is a guy who, you know, was not dwelling on the ball, was maybe not as aggressive for much of last season as you would have thought, given everything we know about Jabari Parker leading up to the draft and even sort of early in his NBA career before he tore his ACL. So seeing him get more aggressive after the All-Star break was encouraging, scored around 19 points a game on good efficiency, but a guy that obviously he has to earn his money in the NBA by scoring. And he's definitely been very aggressive looking for a shot in the first couple of preseason games. And I think he's going to be a guy that if you look at, you know, statistically who potentially has a big breakout in scoring terms, I think he's a guy that has to pick up a big part of that load. And, you know, if you can get Jabari to the point where, you know, he's a 20 plus point per game scorer, if Giannis, you know, has no choice but to really become more of a, you know, a bigger time scorer, sure, their efficiency may go down a little bit, but I think, you know, absorbing that pressure, carrying that load could certainly be a good thing for them long term. You know, in the very short term, I think you're going to find out pretty quickly if you've got anybody at the guard spots. Rashad Vaughn, for instance, you know, they've got a few weeks before they have to pick up his team option. All eyes have been on him. He missed the second game with an ankle injury. But certainly given how poorly he played last year, you know, kid, I think, is giving him a chance to sort of prove is he an NBA player or not. He's still very young, but he was all sorts of bad last year and kind of historically bad terms. So interesting to see that. And so I think in the other big picture, issue is obviously the draft, and they have their own pick this year, and it's supposed to be a great draft. So certainly if the Bucks are a, you know, top 10 picking team, if things really go off the rails and they're, you know, 5-6 in the draft, they could potentially add a really valuable piece. And I think when you look at this roster, I know you guys have discussed with Danny, you know, well, looking at what the Bucks have done and their cap kind of longer term, this is kind of the base of players and or assets that they're going to have to make do with. They're not going to have a ton of cap room to go out and add a star player next summer, or, you know, barring some really big change in the cap or the collective bargaining agreement. So, you know, if you go into the lottery and you get an impact player who can be, you know, 2-3 years from now, a guy that starts and is a big impact player, you may look up back on the injury and say that was absolutely essential to this team eventually being maybe a contender. So I think those would probably be the big ones. Just, you know, again, letting those younger guys sort of take on a bigger role. And then who knows, the silver lining of if they do struggle and kind of fall out of the playoff race really quickly, they get a chance to, you know, Thon Maker, another guy who right now may not have a lot of minutes, but if they're out of the playoff picture, maybe he's a guy who gets a lot more run. And then, you know, maybe you're picking very high in the draft in June.
Yeah, you really encapsulated pretty much everything that I was going to say, because at point guard and center, despite the fact that they have many, many millions of dollars wrapped up in those positions, you really don't have anyone with much upside. Maybe Thon would be the only one if he becomes a center eventually, but that's a ways away. And certainly at point guard, I think as well, getting someone who's maybe a little bit higher end than Dellavedova, who not a terrible signing, but certainly the way that they capped themselves out this year, they didn't have a way to improve. And so I think getting someone with more upside at those two positions that they can throw into the mix could be big for this team long term, because as you mentioned, the reason that Danny and I were critical of what they had done, and especially when you look at, say, the Plumlee contract, for example, that they were really just locked into this team, that even if Jabari and Giannis were to get to what you would hope that they would be, probably doesn't project to be quite good enough at some of the other positions that they would really be a contender. And now they have another chance at that. And you got to remember that Giannis, you know, was so young. I mean, he's 22. Jabari is like 21 or whatever it is. So they've got plenty of time with these guys. You know, five, six years from now is probably when this team is going to be at its best with those two players in their prime. So, I mean, you said the reasons for why this might be a good thing in the long term, but I mean, what do you think if you just had to pick? And I mean, it's so ridiculous to think of this, that, like, maybe their best player getting injured could be good for the team, but is this good for the team overall or not that this happened?
Well, I'll still say no, just because, again, you know, the nature, as you mentioned, a 6-month injury on a hamstring. Again, there is some history of this. I know actually David Alchek, who did the surgery. I think he's done a bunch of these and has contributed to the literature on recovery from these types of hamstring avulsions. But you never want to kind of count that everything's just going to be perfect and fine when a guy comes back. So I think, you know, just looking at Chris and what he was going to mean to this team, and also just in the long term as well, this was, I think, you know, a season where they were hopefully for their benefit going to put things together a little bit. Whether they're going to make the playoffs or not, I think that was obviously debatable, but they would at least give themselves a chance. And also, I think, just give the organization a better sense of how all these pieces fit together. You know, we mentioned, I think it's a good chance for some of the younger guys, and certainly some of the guys that you know are going to get more minutes because of Chris's absence, to get a read on them. But in terms of the big picture, you know, if they win 30 games or if they win 37 games, you know, how you evaluate the job Jason Kidd has done and what the true ceiling of the team is, I think it's going to be pretty difficult because of the circumstances that we mentioned. So, you know, that might be a bit short-sighted. I think certainly the franchise has probably got a taste of maybe the, you know, getting into the playoffs a couple of years ago and all the surprising positivity that came around that. That probably set expectations too high last year and maybe even set expectations too high this year in terms of, you know, feeling like, okay, we got to start winning games, got to start getting playoff experience. I think the experience is a positive thing, obviously, for young players. But as you said, by the same token, you know, you're not going to take Giannis at 21, Jabari at 21, and those guys aren't going to lead a team to 50 games. It's just not, you know, 50-win season. That's not realistic. You're really trying to build something for 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. And I think certainly winning games at some point, you have to do it. But by the same token, you know, as we've outlined, maybe in the long term, maybe, you know, there are some positives that can outweigh the negatives.
And it does seem like they have some long-term stability now in the front office, having brought in Justin Zanuck from Utah, very highly regarded, someone that I've had some interactions with and have come away very impressed with also. And I think when you have that now, this longer term plan might work. And I actually still think it might be better in the long term, although, you know, you can't discount the fact that, you know, they might win 8 or 10 less games this year because of this injury. You know, that counts. It's not like championship or bust. You know, these are fans who are watching the team this year and now they're not going to be as good. So you don't want to discount that. But I think if their plan had been to not sign Giannis and try and use cap space and add a piece, then I think the Middleton injury really would have hurt them because they would have looked much less attractive to potential free agents, you know, versus if they'd been able to contend for the playoffs with Middleton in the lineup. But now that they've basically punted on that idea with that Giannis extension, which I actually intentionally have not talked about on my show yet, I want to get your thoughts on it. But now that they've basically given up cap space for next year, I think that, you know, getting the draft pick is probably, and I mean, I think these guys could be well into the top 10. We'll see. And, you know, depends what lottery luck has to say on that as well. But yeah, let's move to that Giannis extension, because I wanted to get your opinion on that. 4 years, Was it 100 million? Is that right?
Yep, 100 million, even from what I've seen. Yep.
Certainly seems like a steal on a per year basis, but also, you know, they did give up the chance of getting cap space next summer and maybe adding another potential starter and using his low cap hold. And also, it's only 4 years instead of five. So kind of some dueling things there. What are your overall thoughts on that extension?
Yeah, I think over the summer, even going back to last season, I mean, I think my view was, you know, hey, if you can get him for 5 years, no options, just write the blank check, you know, whatever the designated player max is going to be. I would be fine with that just because a guy at his age, you know, entering the season at 21, right? I mean, signing a $100 million extension at the age of 21 is pretty crazy.
To interrupt for just a second, I mean, the other thing I should have mentioned too that's big here is we didn't know what the max was going to be next year. And so either he would have been very unlikely to qualify for designated player under the current rules because he would have had to have won MVP this year. But if he were to if the rules were to change under the new CBA and the max were to go higher, now he's actually locked in for a price versus if you just write on the extension the max. But to get 5 years, he would have had to have been the designated player and gotten at least the 25% max. So that's the only way they could have given him the 5 years was to kind of have that open-ended chance that it could end up being a lot higher than under the current rule.
Yeah, and the other, you know, in talking to people, the other thought that I had heard was just that, well, you know, could the 25% figure, could that change potentially in the CBA? Probably it's not, but, you know, by basically, you know, signing up for that, maybe even if he's not, you know, a true designated player qualifying, you know, as an MVP or two-time All NBA or a two-time All-Star, maybe he, you know, would get pushed up into a bigger number, or, you know, just the cap goes up because the players get back, you know, a couple percent or something like that. So I think I kind of came around eventually. And see, Nate, you made me feel better because I listened to the extension podcast and you as the agent were really pushing for 4+1. So when Giannis got just 4, then I felt, oh, okay, you know, Nate was pushing for 4+1. And obviously, you know, a four plus one with a designated player max versus a 4 year that's not even the max, you know, works out well for the team. So I think getting that certainty was a positive. I mean, you know, getting him for less than what the Blazers got CJ McCollum for, certainly from a market perspective, definitely makes you feel good. And I think the other interesting thing too is just the precedent it sets as well. You know, the numbers aren't, you know, the differences aren't big enough that, oh, you're going to go out and sign, you know, a $15 million player next summer or 2 summers from now or whatever it might be. I mean, you know, you're not saving that much over the max, at least based on what we think the max is going to be. So it's not so much, oh, you're going to be able to go out and sign a bunch of guys now because Giannis took a haircut. But I think the interesting thing is, you know, what is the setup for Jabari Parker a year from now? Jabari is a guy who obviously is, I'd say from a value perspective, you know, far less certain to be worth what Giannis was going to be worth this summer. So I don't think, you know, there's any, for instance, I don't think this means, oh, now that they're going to give the designated 5 year deal to Jabari next summer, barring, you know, a crazy breakout from Jabari. But it does sort of send the message, hey, you know, instead of holding out for that kind of deal or a full max or whatever that number is, you know, maybe you can convince Jabari to take the same deal. And that could save you a few million dollars a year in aggregate along with Giannis. And that gives you, I think, better cost certainty. So I think the certainty piece is valuable, knowing what that number is for Giannis. And then it is, you know, valuable, I think, to have him taking less than the max, I think what it says to the rest of the team. And again, I would be sure to point out, I mean, Giannis didn't owe the Bucks to take less than the max.
Right.
I would have, you know, I don't think players owe the franchise that. I mean, this is a business. They got to get paid. But for him to do that, I think said volumes about, you know, what's important for him. And I guess we'll see. Now the Bucks are certainly better situated to make a deal with Jabari next summer. Not so much because they have a 5 year deal they can offer, but I think just, you know, the bar is slightly lower with Giannis taking that number.
You know, I think I agree with most of what you said, but I think just being in the market that they're in, not a team, despite their what appeared at least at the time to be a success with Greg Monroe, that generally attracts free agents, I think I would have rather just locked him up for that extra year. You have to imagine if he was willing to take a 4 year deal for less than the max, he would have taken the 5 year deal with no options. And so I think I would just, especially when you consider how young he is too, there's and his size and athleticism, that, you know, that fifth year of that contract is probably going to be, you know, he's going to be 27 or either 26 or 27. So that's going to be just his absolute dead bang prime. And so just getting him for one more year, even if you had to pay that much more, I mean, that probably would have been, I think, a five-year, $138 million deal at the current projection, and could have ended up being a lot higher for the reasons that we talked about. But even if I had to pay more, I think just getting that last year of him at when he will hopefully be just a dead bang superstar probably would have been worth it for me. But, you know, this is not like some terrible deal at all. I mean, and the other thing you could have done too is just wait until next summer, and then, you know, you still have him restricted and offer him the 5-year deal at that point, which he very likely you would think take. So that or try to arrange that ahead of time. But I think they did well to get him for this little, and I think agents around the league are probably pretty pissed off about this, because, you know, if you're like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope's agent, Giannis right. has a much higher ceiling than Pope. And, you know, when we did that mock extension podcast, Pope got $89 million, and now if Giannis got 100, it's a lot harder for that to happen. So it's a bit of a mixed bag there. I understand why they did it. I would have just tried to get him for that fifth year, just because, and even if you end up having to trade him or something, like he still is under contract for more, doesn't have any kind of an injury history. So I think that fifth year is likely to be of value. All right, let's turn to the team actually itself now. We should still talk about some of the new additions that they had. Matthew Dellavedova, Mirza Teletovic, how do you see those guys fitting in to what Kidd is trying to do this year?
Yeah, well, I think both of those guys are clearly, you know, were selected in part because of the way that they complement the rest of the core. And Teletovic, obviously, we mentioned, you know, I think he set an NBA record for threes from a reserve last year. And that's exactly the kind of reserve that the Bucks need after, as we mentioned, shooting so few three-pointers last year. We'll be interesting to see with Middleton out. They have experimented here in the second preseason game with starting Mirza, and Zach Lowe wrote about it. And we did a podcast actually right after the injury, wondering if, you know, maybe do we see lineups now with Giannis at the two, maybe, and Jabari at the three, and Teletovic at the four. They could also obviously try to go with a, you know, small ball lineup with all three playing on the front line and then having two guards. So I think Teletovic is a really interesting player. You know, probably not, you know, he's not a terrible defender. I'd certainly rather have him for, you know, $10 million a year versus Ryan Anderson for 20. Sure. And I think he's going to be definitely a useful guy, and only more useful because, you know, they have so few shooters. And similar with Dellavedova, I mean, the sad part is that, you know, if you want to make a list of the 3-and-D guys on the Bucks right now, that list is Matthew Dellavedova and then crickets. You know, it was really him and Middleton were the two guys that you could say, okay, you know, they're going to bring it on both ends most nights and can knock down open threes when they get those chances. And certainly Middleton being out only makes it more of a, you know, obvious lock for Dellavedova to start at that nominal point guard spot, even if, you know, Giannis is called the point forward or point guard or whatever you want to call him. You know, having Dellavedova start and guard point guards obviously seems like a no-brainer. So I think both those guys, you know, obviously they got paid, they'll have plenty of money, and you know, no one would say that they were complete bargains, but I think relative to where the market was, I think those were fair numbers. And I think they fit very well in with the Bucks, and obviously that's a pretty important thing, right? If you're going to be the highest bidder for a guy, you at least want to be a really good situation for him where you can live up to his potential. So I like those guys a lot. You know, and then certainly Jet, just, you know, veteran bench guy, and again, he probably will play a lot more now with Chris Middleton out, as a guy who can come off the bench and hopefully he still has enough legs to shoot threes and not be completely destroyed defensively. And then, you know, the other big additions are obviously the draft picks, Thon and Malcolm Brogdon, who, you know, Brogdon is kind of right in that mix in the backcourt now with Middleton out, can play both backcourt spots. And Thon might have to wait a little bit just because of all the big guys they have, but he's probably more of a four anyway. And I think he had a solid debut in his second game after an injury. It kept him out of the first, and I think he's a really interesting kind of long-term piece because, you know, maybe he doesn't have superstar upside, but I think given his ability to move in space, switch on to smaller guys, cover ground, and potentially stretch out to the three-point line over time, I think he's could definitely be a really interesting piece for them.
Yeah, I've said before that I think Thon can be pretty good. Whether he, and I think he actually is fleet of foot enough to play a little bit of power forward. I would like him more as a center in the long term. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether he's strong enough and can defensive rebound quite well enough to play at that position. But I do think that he can be pretty good. You know, that lineup that you talked about with Teletovic, Jabari, and Giannis all playing together, that would be really interesting. I mean, I think you would probably end up seeing a lot of times teams putting like their two on Teletovic in those circumstances, just because Giannis and Jabari can do so much with the ball in their hands that conventional size twos may not be able to guard those guys. So I think that could be a lineup that could be very difficult to defend, and getting that shooting with him and with Middleton out, I think oddly that Teletovic could end up being the guy who plays more, even though he's not the same position.
Yeah, and it was interesting last night. I mean, you know, again, we're talking about very small samples against the Mavericks. I think Wes Matthews is mostly guarding Giannis last night, and I generally think teams have had more success defending Giannis with twos, you know, threes, and maybe even sometimes twos versus power forwards, because it does force you to change a little bit. You know, guys defending him with guys who are comfortable on the perimeter, defending ball handlers and pick and rolls, I think is a bit more natural versus trying to put bigger guys on Giannis. And so it'll be interesting to see, because as you mentioned as well, I mean, Teletovic is a guy, I mean, I think the synergy numbers on him in the post last year were like comically little, like meaning they get like two shots out of the post all year. So he's not a guy that you'd expect to go exploit little guys in the post, despite the fact that, you know, he is a strong guy, but that maybe helps him defending in the post, but doesn't seem to do him much good offensively. So it definitely gives opponents some choices they have to make. And obviously with Jabari and Giannis as well, you know, different teams may make some different choices in terms of how they defend those guys. But for the most part, it seems like teams have preferred to put their power forwards on Jabari and just sort of, you know, shade him to, let him shoot jump shots and kind of back off him a little bit. And that'll obviously be a big issue for Jabari, you know, being able to punish teams when they just slack off him, because his natural instinct is always to attack off the dribble. But obviously, again, for a team that hasn't stretched the floor, he's going to have to be able to get comfortable shooting some threes as well.
Yeah, I saw he had like a nice little one leg fadeaway the other night, Jabari, and I'm still a believer in his talent. I hope he's going to be able to stretch it out to the 3-point line this year. And I think the ACL has been something that has really kind of bothered him there, because it seemed like when he came back last year, you know, his jumper was pretty broken. And I noticed this with Derrick Rose as well, and maybe a few other guys, that when, you know, when you've torn your ACL, you're just shooting set shots a lot. And now that he's come back, he looked like, at least last year, that he was halfway between a set shot and a jump shot and was just missing a lot. He wasn't getting the elevation that he got before he injured his leg. How's his jumper looking now at this point? I know it's only been a couple of games, but how is it looking in conjunction with kind of what the feeling is around this?
Yeah, I think we started to see him shoot more threes. I think maybe I'm getting the numbers wrong. I think he missed like his first like 10 or 12 or 13 last year, and then began to shoot more after the All-Star break, sort of when he started doing everything else as well. And I think he's a guy who should at least be comfortable shooting the corner three from the short corner. He hit one out of two threes in the opener against the Bulls, but last night, you know, he played well against the Mavericks, had 21 points on 14 shots, and, you know, was able to just sort of do his bully ball thing and get in transition, and he didn't really even had need to shoot jump shots. So I think it's just difficult, because like when he's if he's off the ball, his natural reaction, his instincts, just everything tells him that he should be ready to catch an attack off a soft closeout. But, you know, again, with this team and the way it's structured, especially, you know, if Greg Monroe's out there and he's demanding touches in the paint and he's kind of clogging things up, you know, there are going to be times where he's going to want to find that 3-point line and be able to hurt teams, because he's going to get open looks all day if he wants them. So I don't think you can, you know, it's difficult, because you don't want to tell him not to be aggressive and not to attack the rim, not to use his athleticism. But it's obviously a fine line he's got to learn to understand in terms of when he should be popping out to that 3-point arc and when he should be attacking. So I think it'll be a work in progress. I'm not sold that he's going to be certainly a high volume 3-point shooter. But could he take, you know, one or two a game, and could he get up over, you know, maybe in the low 30s? I think that's very doable. But I think it's certainly, you know, going to require him to maybe alter his mindset just a little bit and not necessarily always kind of just go on his instincts quite as much.
You know what I'd love to see from these guys, and I think could be really effective, and Dellavedova has experience doing this with LeBron James, are some inverted pick and rolls, 4-1, 3-1 pick and rolls. Dellavedova is a nasty little screener, and he is comfortable doing it with James like he did popping to the three-point line afterwards, and you can't switch that because Jabari or Giannis are going to would just kill in an ISO anyone who's guarding Dellavedova. So I'd like to see them run those types of plays a lot.
Yeah, and we saw Jabari run more pick and roll. I mean, I think Jabari had more plays that he finished, you know, in terms of synergy numbers. He had more plays he finished as a pick and roll ball handler versus as a roll man last year, which is kind of interesting because, I mean, he's nominally, most people would call him a four, maybe a three. And he's obviously a guy who, you know, has physical tools. You'd think he could be a roll man, but he did start to do more kind of playmakerish things last year. They ran a fair number of kind of 4 or 5 pick and rolls with him and Miles Plumlee, and, you know, Plumlee is obviously a good guy to run a 4 or 5 role with, given that his catch radius is pretty big. And, you know, he was in the 99th percentile of finishers on pick and rolls last year. So I think we'll probably see, you know, more of those kind of interesting little non-traditional type of actions. Pick and rolls will be interesting to see. As you said, I haven't noticed it with Dellavedova yet, but certainly with Giannis being, you know, your nominal primary ball handler, everything gets kind of funky from the start. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, hopefully Jabari can pick up some of that playmaking load because that was definitely an area where Middleton improved a lot last year. They ran a lot of side pick and rolls with him and he improved a lot in terms of his decision making and being able to be an efficient guy out of pick and roll. So one more area certainly where Jabari is going to, you know, have to pick up some of the slack from Middleton.
So we haven't talked yet about the position in which they have over $50 million tied up this year, the center position. They've got Plumlee, who was re-signed to 4 years, $52 million. John Henson's 4-year, $44 million extension kicks in. And of course, Greg Monroe got the max last summer. He can opt out at the end of this season. And there are some reports that they tried to move him to no effect this offseason. But how do you see the rotation shaking out at the center position? Because I think it's pretty clear that none of those guys can play power forward.
Yeah, one of the great illusions the Bucks continue to operate under is calling John Henson a forward. And John Henson always likes to say, hey, I played power forward my whole life and it's my natural position. And it's like, no, John, you're not going to be a full-time power forward in the NBA in 2016. So it's tough because I think right now, you know, the default is that probably Plumlee will start. Monroe started the second preseason game, but I think certainly looking at some of the lineups last year with Giannis and Plumlee, and as you mentioned, the chemistry he has as a role man and a guy who can kind of just play, you know, on the baseline and just kind of get out of the way and doesn't need touches. He's a guy that I think fits in pretty well with them. And obviously they gave him probably way too much money because they believe that. So I think Plumlee probably makes the most sense as a starter right now. Certainly not a guy you'd look at and say, you know, he's your lock starter for the next few years, but he certainly fit wise can make some sense there. And then, you know, Monroe, I think is too productive not to play minutes at this point. And so that kind of leaves Henson as probably the odd man out for now. And I think that's obviously a big reason why, you know, when especially the Plumlee deal happened, people thought, oh, okay, well, Monroe, I mean, do they have a Monroe deal lined up? Like, clearly, you know, Monroe is going to be gone soon. And, you know, we're still waiting a couple months later for that to happen. So I think it'll be interesting to see. Monroe looked he looked really good in the preseason opener against the Bulls, you know, looked fine against Dallas in a starting role. If you can bring a guy like that off the bench and have him be engaged and, you know, working on both ends, I think certainly he can be a guy that adds something. But, you know, then you kind of look at it from a different perspective of, you know, he can opt out next year. He's clearly not kind of part of your long-term plan. If you had any chance to get any type of value for him, clearly you'd probably want to do that at this point. And certainly that seems to be what the Bucks are thinking, but just have not found any takers for Monroe. And so I think it'll set up kind of an uncomfortable situation here probably until they do find something. You know, maybe somebody's center goes down, maybe some team becomes interested in him, or maybe they look to move Henson if they think they can get a decent wing back in return. But certainly it's an uncomfortable logjam, as you said. The amount of money they have dedicated to a position where they don't have a long-term starter is not great, to say the least. And will definitely be an ongoing thing that I think everybody's going to be curious to see how it plays out if these guys can all stay happy.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see whether Monroe opts out. I mean, you would think that just not wanting to be there anymore could be a big reason for him to do that. But also, he might not necessarily have, at least for next year, just you know, on a per year basis, as much money as he's scheduled to make, which I think is about $18 million in 2017-18. And you know, maybe he could go somewhere else and get, you know, $12 million a year for 3 years or something like that. But maybe he just will be interested in hoping to get a trade and rehab his value or something along those lines. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back with Frank Madden after this.
So let's take a quick break to talk about underwear. MeUndies is a longtime sponsor of the show. You can get started with them at MeUndies.com/capspace. I mentioned my friend on the last time we talked about MeUndies, whose girlfriend told him that he needed to upgrade, and so he did, and now she's very happy with his underwear. I'm very happy with mine as well. They're definitely the most comfortable pair of underwear that I've ever owned, and the reason why is Modal, the special fabric made with best-in-class raw materials that are scientifically proven to be 3 times softer than cotton. So don't be a science denier. Buy yourself a pair of MeUndies using that MeUndies.com/capspace link to get 20% off your first order. Also, let them know that you came from us, of course, which is critical to having them continue to advertise on the show. And of course, you can get free shipping, and they will also let you keep your first pair for free if you don't agree that they're the most comfortable, best-feeling undies that you've ever had. So that's MeUndies.com/capspace to get 20% off your first order, and also let them know that you came from us.
All right, so which of the prospects slash unknown kind of players on this team do you think can emerge into rotation spots? We've got Rashad Vaughn, who you mentioned, Malcolm Brogdon, their second-round pick, Thon Maker as well. Those are really the three guys who are young, don't really have a ton of pedigree yet, or are just too young. Do you see any of those guys being able to emerge and actually be factors for this team?
I think in terms of guys who could make an impact that, you know, tangibly really helps them win more games, I don't think there's anybody that really jumps out at this stage for this season. But I think if you look at it big picture, I think certainly Maker is the longer term guy that you'd look at as having the most upside and potentially the most valuable given the other guys they have on this team. I think as far as this year goes, you know, Vaughn, it's tough with Vaughn because the kid's only 20 years old, but the numbers he had last year, I mean, you know, 30% from the field, 29% from three. I think his PER was a shade over four. I mean, the list of guys who played 1,000 minutes, he played 1,001 and have put up some of the numbers that he put up last year is not a great list. It's a very inauspicious group to be grouped with. And so it makes you wonder, you know, a lot of rookies struggle, but rookies don't struggle like this normally. Yeah, so
that's amazing that he played 1,000 minutes. That just shows you how bad their depth was last year. And before Middleton went down, I was hopeful that maybe they could be a lot better this year because they're just going to be excising all these guys who are just horrendous from the rotation with, you know, and that this team could go 9 deep with quality NBA players, even if some of them were overpaid. But now with just this gaping hole of the two, I mean, either Vaughn or Brogdon has got to play, right?
It would certainly seem like it. You know, I don't think you're going to play Jason Terry 25 or 30 minutes. You know, Vaughn, I just can't buy into Vaughn at this point. I need to see something. You know, he didn't have a good summer league. He was, I think, 1 out of 6, 1 out of 7 in the first game in Chicago. You know, doesn't make an impact on defense, is certainly not a positive one. So it's just kind of hard to figure out what value he's adding. And certainly unless he
started,
to make
right?
Threes.
Didn't kids say they were going to start him when the Middleton injury happened?
Yeah, they said basically he was going to start camp as the starter. And I think part of that was probably sort of all right, Rashad, we got to make a decision on your third year option in a few weeks. Hey, why don't you go prove us something? show us that you can play. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, again, he's so young that, I mean, I would guess they'll pick up the option just, you know, regardless, but who knows? I mean, he didn't play a lot in the second game because of injury. And I think the deck is certainly, you know, there's a lot of questions. Let's just say that. So Brogdon, I think is interesting because he's a more mature guy. I mean, he's 23 years old, a guy that is, doesn't really make mistakes on both ends. Proved it in Vegas. I think he had 22 assists, 3 turnovers, playing mostly point guard. So I think he has a bit more versatility, certainly, than Vaughn does, being able to handle
the
ball.
Can he shoot at all? I think if he could shoot, I think he actually could be a player.
That's the question. I mean, I think he was 39% from the college three, a 90% free throw shooter. And so you'd kind of look on paper and say, wow, those are some, you know, good looking things from a projection standpoint. You know, is he going to be able to stretch out? But, you know, you just watch him shoot threes. He's got a bit of a hitch in his release. Might not be as big of a deal when he's spotting up, but I think certainly when he's shooting off the dribble, it just looks like a guy who can't get the ball to the basket.
That's entirely. Exactly right. Like it just doesn't look like a comfortable stroke for him from the NBA three-point line.
Yeah, so I think that's the big question for both of these guys. Obviously, if one of them hit 35% of their threes, then I think the conversation is totally different. If Brogdon can hit 35% of his threes, then I think he's absolutely a rotation player who probably plays a lot of minutes this year. But it'll be interesting to see. I think, you know, especially Brogdon, the thing I noticed with him is, you know, like a lot of the other Bucks, his mind is not right now on trying to space the floor and getting behind the three-point line when he's off the ball. You know, he's a smart player, he's a good cutter, he does a lot of things, but he still definitely seems to have that mindset of, I'm, you know, playing at the college three-point line. And he's a really smart guy. I think he probably knows that he's not that comfortable there quite yet. So that'll be interesting to see. And I think Maker, you know, probably he's more potentially going to be the victim of just the depth they have at the big spots. But by the same token, Jason Kidd and John Hammond both said over the summer that they expect him to get rotation minutes at some point this season. So we'll be interesting to see, especially, you know, as we've alluded to, if you know, things kind of go south for the team as a whole, or if they can obviously make a move and clear the logjam at the center spot, that would obviously probably be a good thing in the grand scheme of, you know, building on what Maker can do and you know, getting him some valuable minutes in the NBA, because obviously he's coming from a much lower level of play as a high school guy. So so Thon's certainly the guy I'm most optimistic about, but you know, by same token, he might not play too much this year just because of some of those rotational questions. But by the same token, Bucks have generally played, you know, and Kidd has not been afraid to play rookies. You know, he played Rashad Vaughn 1,000 minutes last year, as we said.
Yeah.
So you know, he seems to be high on Maker. Maker, I think, has impressed a lot of people with just his defensive awareness and just his ability to move his feet and kind of, you know, not make as many mistakes as you might think a rookie would make. So you know, I'm optimistic, hopefully, that he'll get a shot at some point this year, maybe not the first month of the season, but at some point.
Yeah, I do think that Brogdon could be useful because he's going to be 24, I think, in December, and he's just kind of a tank, and I think that would allow them to switch 2 through 4 pretty effectively if he's there. Vaughn does not really offer that option. And then, of course, the other thing is that I think, much maligned as Michael Carter Williams is, he was their point guard of the future as recently as a year ago. They traded Brandon Knight for him, and although they also got Plumlee and they got Tyler Ennis in that deal, but he was really the centerpiece. And you know, granted, he shot poorly, they didn't play well, he had that hip injury that ended his season prematurely. But I mean, I think if you had to say who's the best basketball player between Vaughn, Brogdon, and him, it's still pretty clearly him.
Yeah, I mean, and the hard part, you know, with MCW is not just what MCW is in isolation, but what he is in the concept, you know, in relation to the other players on this team. And we've obviously, you know, mentioned the Bucks' struggles from three and the lack of floor spacing they have in general. And you know, defensively, obviously, you look at MCW as you mentioned, and you say, wow, that what a great, you know, potential weapon to have. He's not always a disciplined defender, but he's a guy who makes plays out of his area from the point guard position. He comes up with huge rebounds. He blocks shots at the rim from time to time. He's a playmaker that, you know, certainly in the Bucks style of defense, sometimes he might be a little too chaotic, but I think he brings a lot of ability there that, you know, you wish you could find a way to really harness. But offensively, you know, his playmaking, I think, has probably been the biggest disappointment. You know, we all knew he wasn't a great shooter, and that would be maybe a difficult thing to overcome. But, you know, look at his assist numbers, look at his turnover numbers, really haven't been indicative of a guy who's a great passer, a great playmaker. He's got a handle that comes and goes, you know, just doesn't always look that coordinated, which is not something you want to say about a point guard. So it's tough because, I mean, you talk about, you know, MCW versus a guy like Ben McLemore, who he's been, you know, rumored to the Bucks have offered McLemore, MCW for McLemore, and you say, well, I think MCW is a more, you know, impactful NBA player, but you know, there's a reason the Bucks are looking, you know, apparently we're looking to make a deal like that, and obviously fit is part of it, but just the other part is just, you know, trying to fit him into a team with a guy like Giannis around. I mean, can you play MCW off the ball with Giannis? Probably not very well, especially offensively. So it's just difficult. And I think it does seem like he's at least embracing the idea of being a sixth man, which I think is an important step for him, because he, you know, hopefully realizes that there aren't a bunch of teams lined up to take him and make him a starter. So I thought that would probably have to happen at a different team, and you know, maybe the next team would tell him to go watch Sean Livingston tapes and model himself after Livingston. But maybe he's figuring it out here in Milwaukee, and if they can't move him, then you know, hopefully they can make something out of him, and it'll be a positive, especially going into a contract year.
You mentioned the way that they play. That Bucks defense was very, very effective in 2014-15, number two in the league. They were very active. They trapped a ton. And then last year, whether it was personnel, whether it was the league figuring it out, they ended up just giving up a ton of threes, not getting as many turnovers. They were horrible on the defensive glass. And I think a lot of that is personnel, losing guys like Pachulia and Jared Dudley, who executed the system so well 2 years ago. But are they still going to do that same system where they're really going to be aggressive on pick and rolls, or do you foresee them trying another approach this year?
Yeah, I imagine there may be some tweaking to it. You know, whether they, you know, on the weak side, they, you know, the guy defending the far corner, maybe that guy isn't as aggressive, whatever it might be. But I mean, what we've seen early in the preseason, you know, I mean, they were trying to trap the Bulls in the first game. They were doing some, you know, full court pressure type stuff. I think they are still probably intent on being a team that tries to force turnovers first and foremost, which obviously is very different from, you know, what a lot of teams kind of run with the more conservative kind of Tibbs style defense and you know, not trying to help off. And I'm sure you and many people listening probably read the post that Stephen Shea wrote about, you know, looking at data from the 14-15 season and figuring out how much teams collapse on defense. And, you know, the Bucks were right at the top of that. And 2 years ago, that seemed to work in terms of being able to force turnovers. Last year, it did not seem to work. They still forced a decent number of turnovers, but they really got killed everywhere. I mean, they have a higher percentage on two-pointers in particular. They allowed a lot of open threes. And so, you know, I think a lot of it just so started at just the point of attack and the integrity that, or lack of integrity they had there. So so I don't think they're going to completely overhaul their defense. I think they're going to hope that adding a guy like Dellavedova at the point, you know, if you start Plumlee rather than Monroe, that obviously helps. And then, you know, you're hoping that a guy like Jabari at least wakes up a little bit and can exert himself or focus at a higher rate this year than he did last year, because certainly he's a guy that has a long way to go before he can, you know, claim to be a passable NBA defender. So it will be interesting to see. You know, again, I imagine that they're going to run something similar schematically, but obviously I think that's a huge question, because if this team's going to be competitive at all, especially losing Middleton and what he does for the offense, I mean, he helps the defense too, but at this point, you know, I feel like if they're going to really hang their hat on anything, that it's probably going to have to be more on the defensive side, which I know when we discussed the how this team was going to improve before the injury, we kind of debated that a little bit, whether it's going to be offense or defense. But I don't know. I just have a really hard time seeing this offense without Middleton being above average. And, you know, maybe defensively, maybe they could get to average.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern now with the offense getting better. Last year, they were 26th in offensive rating and 23rd in defensive rating. And yeah, it really is hard to imagine. And maybe just having Teletovic, having Dellavedova, two guys, they didn't really have a stretch four option who was any good last year. They didn't have point guards who were shooting the three. I guess they had Bayless, but I think Dellavedova may be a little bit better in that category as far as his ability to both run a pick and roll on the backside and also shoot open threes. So maybe that just having more spacing on the floor, even though you don't look at them as having more talent offensively than they did last year, just having those shooters at two positions instead of one and playing Carter Williams less, maybe Maker will play a little bit. He can space the floor. Maybe they can just find some ways and just not have guys like O'Brien and Vaughn, just who are like total offensive zeros. At least there still doesn't look like anyone like that in the rotation, except maybe some of those guys with the two. So maybe they could get better on offense. I am a little skeptical though, as you are. What do you see as the big strengths of this team then? You know, we've talked about it a little bit, but anything you haven't mentioned yet?
Well, I think for the, you know, I was just going to say, it jumps off of what we were just discussing. I think the big emphasis for the offense has to be to try and push the ball and play with better tempo. And they did that after the All-Star break with Giannis. I think they upped their transition scoring by over 3 points per game, despite their pace nominally remaining the same. So I think the half-court offense was probably about as slow as it ever was, but they, with Giannis and Jabari being able to grab rebounds and then really attack in transition, they seemed to take better advantage of that, those skills. And obviously those skills you still have, if you can get a guy like Teletovic on the court. We saw it last night early in the game. He was coming as a trailer on a transition situation, and he pulls up for like a 28-foot three-pointer that he buries. So I think being able to use that athleticism they have, try to get out in transition more, that's absolutely essential. I mean, I think they became pretty good at it late last season. The defense, obviously, I think in part why they remain aggressive is because they feel like they have to do that to really spark the offense. And so, assuming we see some similar principles, assuming there's still a team that forces turnovers, that obviously should help them to play a bit faster. Obviously, you have the defensive rebound. That's pretty important, too. And they've been terrible in that regard. So especially a guy like Jabari, who's been really bad on the defensive glass, you hope that you see real tangible improvement from him. So certainly, I think that, if there's going to be an offensive calling card of this team, it's not going to be by grinding it out and playing slow and playing fast and also using that to get more open threes, which is obviously an area they have to improve. I think that's probably the big one. And obviously just finding ways to keep Giannis and Jabari engaged, involved, getting them in situations where, they're running downhill. I think those are, if they're going to have any strengths offensively, that's really where it's going to be.
Yeah, I think that having both Giannis and Jabari, if he ever gets a defensive rebound, as guys who can grab and go and really push the ball in transition. And that, if you don't have a big man back when those guys are coming at you, like, it's going to be a layup. Like, you have to get your bigs back in the lane, or Giannis or Jabari are just going to Euro step around whoever that small guy is, or go on and dunk on people. So that's definitely a concern for opposing defenses. I would say the other thing that I look at as a strength for them is just scoring one-on-one. I think that Jason Kidd, in a lot of games, he really likes just running a small pick and roll, getting the matchup, and then guys like Giannis, Jabari, even Carter Williams, when he's got a smaller point guard guarding him, those are all guys who can really attack one-on-one, just kind of play some bully ball. And you hope that the spacing is good enough to enable that. Monroe, also a guy who can post up, especially against second unit centers. He can probably be effective there if he's not starting. So I would look at that. What about weaknesses other than just the overall defense and the defensive rebounding and I guess three-point shooting? It's a lot of weaknesses, I guess, maybe why these guys aren't going to be that good. But anything else point out to you besides that, since I think we've hit on all those pretty extensively already?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are the big ones. And I think in general, interesting defensively, they were 15th in the league in points per play allowed when you look at the synergy numbers, which, not surprising that they would be better on a points per play basis, given that they allowed more plays probably because of all the second chances they allowed. So I think that's really a big issue. And in the first two games, I mean, they've allowed a fair number of offensive rebounds in those two games as well. And I think part of it's just, playing as chaotically as they sometimes do, they end up, probably not being in good situations where, guys just have the man to box out and they can just sort of easily match up with guys on the board. So part of it's probably personnel. Part of it's sort of, some guys just aren't wired to rebound maybe the way that you'd like them to. And some of it probably is also the scheme a bit, allowing more second chances. But yeah, certainly I think the challenge for them obviously is on both ends, right? I mean, when you start off at bottom 10 in the league in both offense and defense, if you want to get in that playoff conversation, you got to get average in both or much better in one versus the other to compensate. And I think at this point, especially after the Middleton loss, it's just difficult to find, the ingredients to really get really good in any one thing. But they're young, they're athletic, they can push the ball, and obviously I think that's going to be the starting point.
Yeah, the other thing I might point to is just experience is a big weakness for these guys. Middleton has been around for a little bit. They did add Teletovic, but he's not the type of guy you look at as, some great leader. I mean, the element that they had from Dudley and Pachulia 2 years ago, especially intelligence on the defensive end, while Dellavedova, I think, can help with that a little bit. He's still pretty young himself, and he's also not a guy who's going to be at the back end of the defense. So I think that just overall basketball IQ, experience, I could see this as a team that's just going to kind of mostly out of youth, but I think they're just going to make a lot of dumb mistakes, basically. And that's going to be a problem for them.
Yeah, and actually, one thing just to circle back, not a weakness, but I think potentially a strength for them. I mean, and this is obviously based on the assumption that you can keep Monroe happy in a six-man role, that you can keep MCW happy and kind of channel his skills in the right direction. I think potentially this could be a very solid to good bench unit. You know, if you have the luxury of having a post scorer like Monroe in the second unit, and you can put some, a couple shooters maybe around him, even if one of them is a 39-year-old Jason Terry, but if the other is, say, Teletovich, you've got MCW, and then, you know, you assume you're always going to have at least one of Giannis and Jabari probably on the court most of the time. It's, you know, a young team, but potentially, given the way that, you know, some of these guys don't fit with the starters, I think it could at least give them some interesting options off the bench. So we'll be interested to see, because obviously those guys are also the ones that we're talking about potentially getting traded. But, you know, a couple years ago, this was a team that really on the strength of the bench started off very well in that 41 win season. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, especially with the starters getting that huge blow, losing Chris, you know, can they rely on the depth to maybe carry them to maybe a better result than obviously many of us are expecting.
Yeah, Teletovich, Carter Williams, and Monroe, that's a pretty solid 6-8 on a team. The problem is that, you know, you don't really have a number three now with Middleton out, you know,
right.
So it's really, yeah. Those guys are more kind of like your 5-7. And then, you know, Dellavedova is probably like, if he's going to be the guy who gets the third or fourth most minutes on the team, he's someone who I think is certainly below average in that role as a third or fourth banana. But yeah, really quickly, is Michael Beasley going to play at all? They made that trade for him. They gave up to Tyler Ennis, who I would guess they probably were just going to decline his rookie option anyway. I guess the thinking was we need a little bit more shooting or someone who can play make, but you know, I don't really see the fit that well, because I think he's pretty redundant with what Jabari and Giannis already.
Yeah, I had a hard time sort of forming an opinion that move mattered really in the grand scheme of things. Although maybe it was just because this was, you know, a day after the Middleton news and I was feeling very nihilistic about things. I don't think, you know, and he matters much in the grand scheme, certainly of the franchise. Obviously he's on a very cheap 1-year deal. And when you're paying a guy $1.4 million, obviously if you know, he's a disaster and he doesn't work with anybody or whatever, then you can always just buy him out and get rid of him pretty easily. I don't know. It's tough to say. I mean, you know, watching him play, especially with when you have him out there with a guy like MCW, who's also, you know, not really a stay in his lane type guy. Let's just say it's interesting to watch a lot of, you know, mid-range off balance forced shots that, you know, a guy like Beasley is talented enough to make enough of them that he doesn't immediately get the hook. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, he certainly is another scorer. He hit a couple of corner threes in the first game of the preseason against the Bulls. He's a 41% career shooter from the short corner three. So, you know, potentially, hey, if he was willing to kind of play within a scheme and focus on doing stuff like that, then that would obviously be valuable. But, you know, last night he was like the primary playmaker at various times. And, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just too old to enjoy Michael Beasley as a playmaker.
he considers himself the primary playmaker whenever he's on the floor, I think. But I also just worry about it because with Carter Williams' situation about to be a free agent in a contract year, Monroe maybe in a contract year, guys who aren't necessarily going to play as much as they would like to, as much as they were really brought in to do when they were first acquired. And now you throw in Beasley as another guy, maybe not like, you know, and you have an impressionable young roster. And in some respects, I think just from a chemistry standpoint, I'm not sure how much he's giving you to where it's really worth it to just bring in another guy who might potentially be unhappy or just be kind of weird or not that focused or professional, which has been his reputation. Although, you know, you didn't at least hear those stories from him out of Houston. All right, let's get to the meat of it here. Best case scenario for these guys.
Best case scenario, I would probably guess, you know, everything kind of falls right. You get guys, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of guys in contract years, you either trade them in deals that get you better, you know, value or they can find ways to embrace their roles. And, you know, a guy like Monroe can be a good second unit scorer and things like that. Obviously, Giannis, Jabari, those are the most important guys. I think any best case scenario starts with them and them taking big leaps up. So I think with this roster, you know, could they get, you know, maybe high 30s, I have such a hard time seeing this team get into the low 40s without Chris Middleton, even in a best case scenario, that it's hard for me to even get there. So, that's probably my best case scenario. I mean, maybe part of me subconsciously is trying to just set expectations really low and then hope I'm pleasantly surprised. But I think that's, you know, to say that they can get into the low 40s and, you know, contend for a playoff spot. I mean, hey, nobody thought the 15 win team would get to 41 wins the year before or 2 years ago. Things can happen, but they're just, I think they'd have to, you know, really completely change defensively, I think, from you know, being in the 20s to, again, jumping into that, you know, probably 5 to 8 range or something like that to even kind of be in that conversation. So I think it's tough to see the playoffs in the immediate future. But as we said, maybe not, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, if they could trade Monroe, and trading big for small, especially big for wing, has become very difficult in this league now. But if they could trade Monroe for just some stopgap, you know, seventh man type of two guard who could hit a three on occasion, you might feel better about them. But I don't foresee that necessarily happening. It's hard to see how the offense gets above the league average. And then even then, for the defense to do it also would be pretty difficult. I mean, you just, like I said, I don't think you have the intelligence level. You don't really have enough guys on this team with the track record of being good defensively. If they just had a center who I thought would be good on defense, I would feel completely differently about this team. Like if they had just signed like Jan Mahimi in the offseason or something, which, you know, they probably wouldn't have gotten Dellavedova and Teletovic if they'd done that. So I'm not saying that would have been the course they should have pursued, but if they just had like a league average defensive center that I felt pretty good about, then maybe you could see how the D could start to take shape. But yeah, it's tough. I would say, yeah, like best case scenario for me would be like 39 wins would be it, just because they just have so far to go on both ends. And their expected one loss last year, they won 33, but they only had the point differential of a 29 win team. And so if you look at that as the baseline, yeah, they're bringing in Dellavedova, they're bringing in Teletovic, that helps. But now they also lost Middleton, which at the most, I think, cancels that out. And so you're just, now you're saying, all right, Jabonis, I was about to say Jari and Jabonis, Jabari and Giannis would just have to take so much of a step forward to make up that. I think, you know, high 30s is probably about the best we could see from these guys if everything were to break right. What about worst case scenario?
Well, you know, I think the stat you mentioned, right, that the differential last year was more consistent with the 29 win team. And obviously they kind of, some different things went into that. I think the last few weeks of the season, they basically, all their guards were hurt. And that's why, you know, Rashad Vaughn had a couple 40 some minute nights the last few weeks of the season. So things kind of, you know, came undone a fair bit late in the season for other reasons. I think worst case, though, I mean, could this team, could everything go haywire and could they be in the, you know, mid to high 20s? It's possible. You know, I mean, nobody thought that the team that won 15 games was, you know, anywhere close to that bad going into that season. So I think this is just a really high volatility team just in general in terms of the potential outcomes. I'd like to think that Giannis and Jabari and with the depth that at least they have right now and what those guys can do, and hopefully no more injuries, that you could get into the 30s with that group. And then, you know, again, maybe you'd have some upside. But, you know, certainly with the way the NBA goes, and I think it's, we're in a really interesting season for Jason Kidd. You know, we had a really positive, surprising first season, which probably set the bar maybe too high for last year for a lot of people. And then obviously last year, though, certainly, you know, 33 wins, 29 win point differential, that's not, you know, anywhere close to what even probably more realistic observers were hoping for. So I think it's going to be a really good test of Kidd and his coaching staff to see, you know, is this a good coaching staff? Is this just sort of an average coaching staff? Well, what is it? But certainly I think, you know, sub 30 is certainly in play.
Yeah, I think that's right. I could see them getting to like 24, 25 if things go wrong. If, you know, I think if Giannis misses time, that I don't think they're going to have much of a chance in those games. You know, and not to say we're not prefacing this on a catastrophic injury necessarily, but if, you know, I think if he misses 10 games, 15 games, that they'll be really, really bad in those games, just not having much of an impetus offensively. All right, official predicted record. What do you got?
I would say probably somewhere in the low 30 range. So maybe 33 wins, 34 wins, something on that range. So, you know, basically kind of somewhere around where they were last year. And obviously there's a lot of kind of, you know, pluses and minuses we're kind of factoring in and out, including some of the improvement that obviously you'd expect to see from the young guys. I mean, that's the most important thing, right? If Giannis and Jabari look phenomenal and they win 30 games, I'd much rather take that than, you know, ride Toledovic having a career year and helping them get to 36 wins or something like that. So I think it'll be interesting to see how those different things shake out. You know, the win-loss record, I think at this point with Middleton gone, is of far less importance than the development questions, you know, especially given the long time horizon realistically that this roster has to be judged over. But yeah, kind of low 30s probably feels like the right range for me.
Yeah, I think I would go, I'm torn between 31 and 32. I guess I'll go 32 as my official prediction there. All right, if you have time, there is a question I want to ask you about the Bucks. I've been asking a lot of people this when they have time. If you had to purchase one Bucks jersey, past or present, with a bias towards the present, you know, authentic $200 Bucks jersey, whose would it be?
Well, sadly, there aren't really that many guys you'd even realistically want to put in the running for this. So, you know, my dad's a season ticket holder, and I think they gave him a chance. They gave him the option of getting any player, current player, authentic autographed jersey 2 years ago when he renewed, and I told him, get Giannis. That's just too easy. Like, we love Jabari. Hope Jabari's good. But I told him to go for Giannis. And I think, yeah, even if you extend it back a ways, you know, there's some cool jerseys from the 80s, maybe, you know, a Sidney Moncrief or something like that might be interesting with some of the old jerseys. But certainly if you're going to be biased towards anybody over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, you know, as much as I enjoyed the big three, Sam Cassell, Ray Allen, Glenn Robinson teams, I can't say that
any of
those
jerseys
guys
weren't that cool either.
No.
I like the ones from the 80s are kind of cool, though. I think the ones that go back to when they were playing in, like, what was it called? Like the Mecca? Was that the name of their old arena? Yeah, I mean, like, Sidney Moncrief would be pretty sweet. He's a guy that a lot of people don't know that much about. And those Bucks teams back in the 80s were really good. They never made it to the finals. They always lost to either the Celtics or the Sixers. But, you know, those teams with Terry Cummings, Paul Pressey. Paul Pressey would actually have a sweet one. The original point forward. That would be kind of a cool one, too.
Or well, I think Marcus Johnson would say, technically, he was the original point forward. And I was going to mention Marcus Johnson would also be a pretty cool jersey if you're going to go with a pass guy. And he's now back in Milwaukee as the color commentator. Taking
was
over
he number 54?
I think he was in college. I think he was number 8 with the Bucks.
Okay. Because 54 somewhat is like kind of a cool number.
Yeah. And it's a little bit, it's kind of odd because I remember when I first started writing and we did something on retired jerseys in Milwaukee. And it's really a bizarre set of jerseys they have retired because, you know, you've got Kareem, who obviously was one of the greatest players of all time. And I think he played 6 years in Milwaukee. So, I mean, he was here a while and won a title with them. But then you've got other guys. I mean, you know, Junior Bridgman, or a great guy, super successful business guy, was here a long time, you know, but not like a star player. Brian Winters has a retired jersey, you know, not a star guy. And Marcus Johnson, in part because he left sort of under negative circumstances in the early 80s, is a guy who still doesn't have his jersey retired. And he's probably the guy that is the most obvious guy to come next. So, you know, he's back in Milwaukee now. And I think it's been great having him back. He's a great guy, a great Twitter follow, has had some great stories. He was on the Woj podcast recently, had some really interesting stories. So he's a guy, I think, if I was going to go old school, I think Marcus would be a cool guy to get the jersey of. And hopefully his jersey will be hanging on the rafters at some point in the next couple of years.
Yeah. All right, man. Thanks for coming on. Make sure you plug all your stuff because I've been enjoying the Locked on Bucks podcast when big Bucks stuff happens.
Yeah, thanks. It's Locked on Bucks. We're part of the Locked on Network, podcasting daily at this point during the week. And for all of our writing, we obviously put all our podcasts there as well, brewhoop.com. I guess we're going to be coming up on our 9th anniversary. So it's shocking that that I've been doing it that long. But yeah, brewhoop.com, at brewhoop on Twitter. And thanks so much, Nate. Really had a good time.
All right. Follow me on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. And thanks to everyone who gives us an iTunes review or rating. That's really appreciated. Everything's going great with the show. And we appreciate all of your support as we're going through the season outlooks. We'll be back tomorrow with more. Talk to you all then.